Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to the Intelligent Design the Future podcast. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting from Discovery Institute, Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. We have on the show with us today a very special guest calling long distance from London in the UK, Dr. James Lefanu, the author of the recent book, Why Us? How Science Rediscovered the Mystery of Ourselves. Dr. Lefanu is a medical doctor in the UK. He did his medical studies at Cambridge and the Royal London Hospital, and he has taught in a number of hospitals in the London area and has a very interesting career path. So, Dr. Lefanu, thank you so much for being on the show with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, we've been very enthusiastic about your book, which is absolutely a wonderful treatment of the subject of biological origins and evolution and neuroscience and whether materialistic science can account for the mind. I want to get into that as we go on in this interview, but first, I'd love to hear a little bit about your background, how you went from being a student of medicine and a medical doctor to being a very widely read writer and commentator on many issues.
Well, I did humanities at school, and then I switched to medicine when I was in my late teens, and I had a great time doing medicine. I really loved it. I still do medicine, but I was doing medicine at Cambridge, and I went to the one big teaching hospital in London. And it was a very exciting time, the late 70s, early 80s, we started doing renal transplants, and it was a very thrilling time generally. And I got very fascinated by the whole process of scientific discovery and, as it were, the broader historical and philosophical aspects of medicine and science. And so after I'd been practicing as an intern in hospitals for about 7 or 8 years, I decided to move slightly sideways a bit, and I retrained in what we call general practice, what you call being a family physician, which I carry on doing 2 or 3 days a week. And then I combined that with writing a couple of medical columns for the big national dailies here, the Sunday Telegraph and the Daily Telegraph. And so that way, I mean, I sort of straddle the two worlds, still practicing medicine and involved in, you know, medical issues, but also writing about things. It gives you an opportunity to take a broad Olympian view. You begin to get a sense of how things fit together and, you know, what's really going on. And so it's been a great opportunity, you know, to be able to do both things, really.
Absolutely. I think that obviously being a commentator on so many issues gives you a very unique perspective on how science applies to society. So for the past 20 years, you've combined working as a doctor in general practice with contributing a weekly column to the Sunday and Daily Telegraph. You've done a lot of other writing as well. I was reading your bio, and you've written articles and reviews for The New Statesman, The Spectator, GQ, the British Medical Journal, the Journal of the Royal Society of Medicine, and you've written other books as well. You wrote an award-winning book, The Rise and Fall of Modern Medicine, in 2001. Could you briefly tell us a little bit about your other book that is mentioned in your bio?
Well, as I said, this really arises out of my initial interest in the history of medicine and this very interesting trend, which was that I identified in a way, which was that the really important, extraordinary, fertile period of medical innovation followed the Second World War, lasted about 20 or 30 years, from about 1945 to 1975, 1980. And that's where most of the really important things that we now recognize as modern medicine happened, and where most of the drugs that are commonly used today were discovered. And it was an incredibly exciting and thrilling and fertile source of innovation. And so all those things that we sort of take for granted, like curing childhood cancer and test tube babies and hip replacements and open heart surgery and all that sort of thing, and that all happened in that period. And essentially it was an attempt to write about why it happened at that time and also how it sort of came to an end. And that medicine is still progresses, but not nearly to the same extent that it did at that time. And that quite a lot of the problems within medicine arise from this fact that it no longer has that great innovative drive within it And it's quite a complex question why this has all happened. It was really the first proper history of this incredibly important epoch of human achievement, which has done so much to change people's lives for the better. So that was that, and I finished that book in 1999. It was published in 1999, and it won the Los Angeles Times Book Award. And I always felt that I had another book in me, which is obviously the second book that we're about to talk about.
Let's get into that book. Your new book is titled Why Us? How Science Rediscovered the Mystery of Ourselves, just published this year by Pantheon Books. And obviously, your latest book focuses quite a bit on the topic of biological origins and whether materialist accounts of evolutionary biology and the mind are sufficient to account for biological phenomena. So what got you interested in the topic of biological origins, making this transition from writing about medicine to the origin of the biological features that you'd been studying your whole life?
I think a whole series of things came together, but essentially, I mean, it starts with the fact is that when you write about science and medicine from a sort of journalistic perspective, it becomes very, very obvious quite early on that not as all as it seems, if you know what I mean. That as soon as you sort of scratch beneath the surface, there's much more going on than is necessarily readily apparent. And this is partly because science presents to the world this facade of knowing, this supposition that essentially it understands the answers to important questions, and if it doesn't understand them now, it will understand them at some time or other in the future. This is the underpinning of the philosophical basis of materialist science. It's the supposition that there is nothing to which ultimately science does not know the answer. And one of the things about practicing medicine and thinking about medicine and biology is, of course, the recognition that of its billionfold complexity. Biology, human physiology, us, you know, transformation of a single cell embryo into a fully grown fetus, these sort of things, these are unfathomably complex phenomena. And practicing medicine and writing about it, you get a feel for that complexity. You feel, you know, that there's nothing in our everyday lives that begins to touch the deep profundity of these phenomena of the living world. And I'd always had, I think, and I was always suspicious of the simplistic idea that there was a relatively straightforward explanation for that, which was essentially the Darwin story of, you know, all this, the whole phenomenon of life can be accounted for as the consequence of a natural process, natural selection acting on the random mutation of genes. It does seem to me to be instinctively implausible that it was, you know, the one. Nothing in biology is simple, and the idea that might be a simple explanation for the richness and diversity of the living world just seemed to me to be intrinsically unlikely.
So it sounds like you have been a skeptic of Darwinism since before you wrote this book.
I think I've probably always been a Darwin skeptic, as long as I can really remember. Not only on those grounds, but also because part of the thing about writing about science and medicine is that you learn to distrust the establishment view, the orthodox view. You know, there's an awful lot of pushing a line in science, you know, talking up things, hyping things, claiming knowledge that is not really possessed, partly because of the practicalities of speaking up the importance of your particular area of expertise in order to ensure that the research funds flowing in on the one hand, or on the other hand, if you are, you know, the scientific pundits, you know, the opportunity to be able to say, we know the answer to this, as opposed to, well, actually, we didn't know the answer to this. So, you know, before one even sort of starts going into the details of why it might be that there is more to biology than Darwin can tell us, there are several reasons for taking a moderately sceptical stance of what is, after all, you know, the conventional orthodox view in these matters.
I think we'll get into some of those reasons in just a moment here, Dr. Leifanu, but you made a comment just a moment ago that I think is worth staying with, how you have often seen that there's a lot of hype about the science, and that you said earlier that scientists, you know, will often put on the facade of knowing as a fact, the answers to many of these deep questions. You obviously are unique in that you straddle both the scientific world and the media world, and you see how science is communicated to the public through the eye of your involvement in the media. Do you see this going on, hype in the media about what we understand about biology and about evolution and about our own origins?
Well, I mean, the answer to that is, you know, so evidently yes. And, you know, the way in which the media operates, it serves the purpose of being the sort of the cipher or the conduit of the prevailing view. So the official organizations like whoever it might be of biologists or the American Association of Science or whoever it might be, or the Royal Society or academia generally, they promote their views through the media. I mean, because the purpose of newspapers and is generally just to, as it were, reproduce without necessarily challenging. This is has become particularly noticeable in the field of, for example, genetics in the last 10 or 15 years, where powerful claims are made about how we are just about to discover the cause of this or the cause of that, or about to produce some new treatment based upon some genetic breakthrough and so on. And part of the role of the media is to talk these things up, as it were. I mean, I haven't put that terribly well, but I mean, it's a self-evident thing that, on the whole, the media does not challenge prevailing certainties in the scientific world.
I agree with what you're saying very much. Obviously, dealing with the media a little bit in my own job, that its job is basically to put its rubber stamp of endorsement on whatever the official line is from the scientific community. At the risk of going a little bit off topic, I'm curious if you follow the recent hype over the fossil named Ida, the primate fossil that supposedly proves our link to the rest of the animal kingdom. Has this been news in the UK and you've been following this at all?
Yes, I have. And it's absolutely fascinating that they found this a 40-million-year-old fossil. But the gloss on that suggests that in any sense it tells us anything of interest about our origins is obviously an absurdity. It's a fossil, but, you know, how that fossil is related to you and me having a conversation, you know, the interesting question. Yeah, everything else, having between that fossil and ourselves, is mere influence, I would say.
What has fascinated me is how the very well-known media promoter of science, Dr. David Attenborough, is, of course, making a documentary, which I believe has already aired on the History Channel, about this fossil. And, I mean, the degree to which they're touting this fossil as the link that proves that humans evolved from lower primates is absolutely astounding. And I've just found this entire episode to be quite interesting, just as far as the media psychology of promoting evolution to the public and how that's done. And I'm sure that in the UK, it's been no different than here in the States.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of get the impression that they've overstepped the mark to the extent of undermining, in a sense, their own credibility. Because if you're just an ordinary person who perhaps doesn't know necessarily very much about this, one might think they were gilding, as we say in England, you know, gilding the lily a bit, extrapolating beyond reasonable facts. I mean, that is obviously a very interesting question, that in a sense, it's precisely at the moment that the conventional evolutionary story becomes very vulnerable to scientific criticism in its own terms, that one finds this tendency to, you know, exaggerate the significance of findings such as that.
The phrase from the great British poet, "Methinks thou doth protest too much," keeps going through my head right now. So let's get into your book, and I think that we're going to have time for just a couple questions about your book, and then we'll have to continue on in a second podcast interview about your book. Do you have time for that today?
That's fine. I'm with you.
Okay, so let's just very briefly talk about the basic premise of your book. The inability of natural selection and random mutation, or our knowledge of the number of genes and genetics, to account for what we observe in biology. Is this correct? I mean, can you elaborate on the basic premise of your book?
Can I just put it in a sort of historical context? Yeah.
Oh, yes, please.
I mean, I think this is probably the best way to look at it. I mean, my take is this. If we look at the scientific achievement of the last 60 years, it is, you know, one of the supreme intellectual achievements of our species, where for the first time in our history, we are able to hold in our mind's eye the whole of the history of the universe the moment it started till practically yesterday. And that is, it's an extraordinary thing that when I was born in 1950, that, you know, we didn't know, there was no story of the Big Bang, we didn't understand the dimension of the universe, we didn't understand how the solar system was formed, we didn't know the code of life, and now we do. And it is a really, you know, an absolutely staggering achievement, this. And we are infinitely privileged to have lived through a period in which science has brought this to our attention and made a coherent story out of it. And then what happened was that in the late 70s, early 80s, there were two really outstanding questions that needed to be, which still remain to be resolved. And that was, essentially, what is the nature of genetic inheritance? How do you get from the genes strung out along a double helix to the richness and diversity of the living world? And how do you get from the monotonous electrochemistry of the brain to the richness of subjective experience and thought and imagination of the human mind? And these were the two big questions
that
remained unresolved. And they were unresolved because, essentially, they were inaccessible to scientific scrutiny because you couldn't get at the double helix to find out what it was doing, and you couldn't get at the brain because it was stuck within the skull. And then in the late 70s and early 80s, a whole series of incredibly important technical developments occurred, which actually allowed scientists to take the double helix and spell out all the genes which were strung out along it and find out the nature of the genes that are passed down from generation to generation and ensure that all forms of life replicate each other with such fidelity. And neuroscientists were able, with these scanning techniques, to be able to observe the human brain in action, thinking, imagining, reflecting on the world. And so one had this sense that, you know, finally these two great, last great obstacles, as it were, or the two last great unresolved questions were waiting to be resolved. And that is what, as it were, has preoccupied science for the last, you know, 10 or 15 years. And what is really interesting, and essentially what my book is about, is how these two disciplines, these two areas, for all that we might know about the history of the universe and how it came into being and how big it is and the code of life, for all that we might know, these two last areas, these two, as it were, final questions, have proved deeply elusive, and their findings lie outside, or appear to lie outside, the common understandings of material science. That is to say that there is more to both these questions than material science can tell us. So that gets back to your original question. I think it is important to put it in that sort of historical question. You know, what is the significance of the findings of genetics and neuroscience in the last 15 and 20 years? How they have, in a sense, utterly changed our understanding, not just of ourselves, but of what it is that materialist science can tell us about ourselves. Because these findings, you know, are utterly unexpected and utterly extraordinary and incredibly surprising.
Well, Dr. Leifenu, that's an excellent teaser and introduction for your book and the basic premise. The title is Why Us? How Science Rediscovered the Mystery of Ourselves by Dr. James Leifenu, published just recently by Pantheon Books. Go check it out. This is not the end of our discussion with Dr. Leifenu about his book. I'm Casey Luskin, so stay tuned for more on the ID Future podcast.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2008. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.